Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Part two of a three-hour Frontline documentary series airs tonight on SDPB-TV. That's at 8 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Central. Bitter rivals Iran and Saudi Arabia looks at war in the Middle East, going far beyond headlines about a battle to defeat ISIS to look at what's at stake in the battle for dominance that kills indiscriminately. Frontline producer and correspondent Martin Smith talks to political and military leaders from both countries, gains access to Yemen for a look at devastation, and listens to experts on the violence, including those who are struggling daily to survive it. Martin Smith joins us on the phone now from New York. Martin Smith, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. Good to be back.
Give us a big picture of the three-part documentary and where we go tonight on Frontline. Where are we going to be dropped into the story?
Sure. So the series takes a look at the history of this rivalry, which dates back to the revolution in Iran in 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, declared an Islamic revolution, and pledged that he wanted to topple all monarchs, including the Saudis. And from there, a number of wars have sprung. Tonight's program, we pick up sort of at the end of the battle against ISIS and follow Iran's ambitions in the region into the war in Syria, the efforts by Saudi Arabia to counter those efforts, and then in Yemen. And in Yemen, where we were the only American crew to gain access in this last, well, since December of 16, we look at the Saudi campaign, which they've been bombing the country relentlessly over the last 3 years. And they're doing it because they fear, they're convinced that the Iranians have designs on establishing an Iranian ally on their southern border, which they find unacceptable.
You say they're convinced and they fear in the same sentence. There's a lot of that in this, you know, in this hour of Frontline, where you have a lot of people who are completely convinced, and they say things like they started it. No, it's not us, it's them. We have to be doing this. They've really dug their heels in a lot of ways. Is that what you came away with as well?
Yeah, well, it's a crowded neighborhood, the Middle East, and so countries have a lot of fear about just how secure they are. And everybody's into everybody else's business, practically. So wars that break out in one place, say in Iraq or in Syria, don't go long before other players have come in and decided to become patrons for one side or another. So Iran, since the revolution in 1979, has been very afraid for its security. And so it's done a lot to try to secure itself in the region. But it doesn't have, or it didn't have, a lot of friends to begin with. Only Syria was really considered an ally. Now they've turned Iraq into an ally, thanks to the American invasion, which really destabilized the country and led it into the arms of Iran. So Iran's been afraid, and Saudi Arabia now is very afraid of what it sees as encroachment by the Iranians all around the region. So fear is a major factor. It's also true that Iran is a revolutionary state that depends on a kind of pride and defiance that has led to a certain amount of aggression.
What's the Iranian strategy in Syria?
Well, the Iranians have come to the aid after the Arab Spring uprising in 2011. Assad, Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, cracked down brutally on the demonstrators, and the Iranians came to his aid, as well as did the Russians. A number of other Shia militias from around the region, from Pakistan to Afghanistan to Lebanon, came in and helped. I think Iran is very interested in carving out a corridor to Lebanon. Lebanon is where they sponsored the first of their foreign ventures in the support of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was coming together to counter the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon. And so Iran put a lot of people on the ground and money into an effort to build up Hezbollah. Hezbollah became a major ally. But in order to continue to resupply Hezbollah, they've needed a corridor. They've needed at least to fly their supplies into Damascus and then ferry them over to Lebanon. Or now, with Iraq being friendly to Iran, they've been able to build a land route right from Iran through Iraq into Syria and over to Lebanon and close to the Israeli border.
Hmm. This episode and this series is doing such a brilliant job of putting together some of these big picture, so we can understand what's happening. But also, there are these deeply human stories of communities and cities and individuals. Let's talk a little bit about some of the places that you went. You're in Mosul when ISIS is pushed out. Tell me about that day.
Well, it's just I'm in Baghdad actually when they're celebrating on the streets the mm-hmm. for the victory over ISIS in Mosul,
okay.
And
okay.
it is mostly Shia population. There was a lot of cleansing during their civil war, and most of Baghdad the overwhelming majority of Baghdad is Shia, and they were out celebrating. The victory over ISIS, which is made up of Sunni extremists. And so there was great jubilation, fireworks, honking of horns and speeches and people showing their pride in the fact that their Shia militias had in some way, in their view, contributed to the victory.
Hmm. Aleppo. You visit Aleppo.
Tell me about
when you're there and what you see.
Yeah, it's really heart-wrenching to go to any of these places across the Middle East and see the amount of destruction. Aleppo was under siege for more than a year, and it's so many of the buildings are flattened, so many of the people have had to flee or were killed. It just boggles the mind as to how they get on their feet again, clear the rubble, and begin to rebuild. It's not clear who's going to really come in to their aid. I mean, it's not like there's a Russia coming in with a Marshall Plan. The Iranians, while they want to be involved and are trying to help rebuild some schools, don't have the kind of capital that the West does. And so it's heart-wrenching. I saw people trying to get their lives back together, but there's been so much destruction there. And Aleppo, you can still feel it. It has the kind of great city feel that even though it's destroyed, half of it, third of it or more is destroyed.
We're talking, if you're just tuning in the moment, SDPB Radio with Martin Smith. He's a correspondent and producer and writer for Frontline. And you can see hour two of this three-hour series, Bitter Rivals, tonight, SDPB TV at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. And Martin, another place that you visit is a Shia holy site. And can't always have your cameras on there. Tell me about what you saw.
Well, they were very touchy about letting us go. When we went to the army, we asked about if we could drive out to this shrine. It's a shrine dedicated to the sister of Hussein, perhaps the most revered saint in all of Shia-dom, Shia theology. It's the shrine of Sayyida Zainab. They told us not to go. We managed to go anyway. We get there, and we're under strict instructions not to point our cameras at any soldiers, but the place was swimming with militia members, militias from Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan. And when we started filming one militia marching, down the street just outside the shrine from Afghanistan. They rushed to stop us. It's that they don't want to show how many of these foreign militias are involved in fighting their war. So they're very sensitive about it. But it's at the same time, there are posters all over town extolling the deeds and the heroism and the martyrdom of these various militias that have come from all over.
How do you get access to Yemen when so many others have not been allowed to go in? What is that process like?
Well, you know, it's somewhat of a mystery to me, even. It did take us a long time and lots of meetings that took place in New York and Washington and in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia and a lot of waiting in Djibouti, which is just across the Red Sea from Yemen. The airports are closed down. There are no commercial flights. There's a United Nations flight that comes in two or three times a week on an irregular schedule, bringing aid workers and supplies, and that's the plane you have to get on. The Saudis control the airspace. It's not a war that the Saudis particularly want you to see, because their bombing campaign has resulted in lots of civilian death. On the other hand, we had been in Riyadh and we had made contacts at the highest level of the government. And a number of times officials said to me that we should see for ourselves what was going on in Yemen. And so I held them to that. And I said, well, if you're serious about that, you have to let us in. They could have easily said no and did for a long time. And finally, they relented. And I can only think that they thought, well, we'll let one crew in, and it was just three of us, a cameraman, my field producer, and myself. And I can only think that they thought, well, we'll let them in, and then we can tell everybody else that, sure, we let people in. We let that crew from Frontline in and then close it down. But we got in there. We had to work around the rebels that are controlling the capital, the Houthi rebels, somewhat. But we managed to stay there for, I think it was over 2 weeks.
Wow. There's a moment when you're there where you're sort of standing over the remnants of an American-made cluster bomb. And I don't know if it's a market or a grocery or, you know, what the facility is. But as someone's really explaining this to you and kind of wiping it off and saying, like, this destruction is connected to the United States, what are you thinking at that moment?
Well, you know, we know, I mean, I know that the Americans have supplied the Saudis with lots and lots of weapons of various types, including cluster bombs. These are bombs that have, each one has 40 projectiles that are all deadly. So I knew these things existed. I was in a cement plant that was key to infrastructure rebuilding and whatnot, and for some reason the Saudis thought that this important piece of infrastructure, this cement plant that employed 1,500 or more people, was a target they should hit, and they hit it with cluster bombs. Doesn't do damage to the plant in any particular way, but kills people, and so nobody wants to go back to work there. I mean, you know, This is a complicated deal whereby the Obama administration wanted to sign a nuclear deal with Iran. And at the same time, they knew they were going to make the Saudis very nervous because the Saudis were saying, look, you're going to do this nuclear deal with Iran. You're going to release some of their assets. They're going to be up to more mischief. So the Obama administration, or the President Obama, said, look, we'll sell you more weapons. And part of that was these cluster bombs. Then when the administration saw how they were being used, that civilians were being killed, they ceased selling them. They canceled those. They didn't sell anymore. But a lot of them are likely still in the Saudi stockpiles. In fact, when I was in one town, one had just fallen 2 days before I arrived. So it's, you know, Americans don't know much about the war in Yemen, and that's kind of the way I think the Saudis like it. But on the other hand, Yemenis know very well where the weapons are coming from. Hmm.
There's a cholera outbreak. There's a massive, hardships, malnutrition, children who are, and there's a physician or a healthcare worker of some kind, female, who talks to you and says she blames everyone for this. She blames her own country. She blames, international community. There's plenty of, accusations to sort of go around.
There's people who are accused of war crimes on both sides of this, whether it's Saudi or whether it's the Houthi rebels who are now in control of the capital. So it's a dirty war. It's a largely hidden war. The current stats, statistics are that there's about 8 million Yemenis that are on the verge of starvation. I saw children that were severely malnourished and talked to nurses who talked about the children who do come into their clinic and who die there. And I talked to a nurse who I asked her who she blamed for the war. And like you say, she said both sides. And the feeling is that nobody cares about the collateral damage. Yemen is the poorest country in the region. Saudi Arabia is among the richest. And Saudi Arabia is leading a coalition with other wealthy Gulf states. It's a very disturbing sight to see. And I don't think I even went to the worst locations in Yemen.
Wow. Frontline producer, correspondent, and writer of this program, Martin Smith, thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate your time. Be safe and keep doing good work for all of us.
Thank you, Lori, for having me on.